Welcome to this deep dive. If you're joining us today, I want you to just think for a second about the last time you went to the doctor.
Or even the last time you tried to explain a lingering health issue to a friend, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Because usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this this expectation of absolute precision. We want it to feel like engineering.
Right.
You break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, the doctor points right to it and says, "There it is." They cast it, it heals.
It's incredibly comforting.
It really is. To have things be visible, you know, to have them neatly categorized, to know exactly what the broken part is.
It creates a massive sense of control. I mean, biomedicine has basically spent the last century perfecting that kind of structural binary thinking. Broken or not broken.
Right. Infected or sterile.
Malignant or benign. Exactly.
But then you step into the world of internal medicine, and especially when we start talking about chronic illness, suddenly that x-ray machine feels completely, entirely inadequate.
It's like bringing a ruler to measure the temperature.
Yes. We end up looking at a diagnostic landscape that is murky, it's confusing, and often incredibly frustrating for the person actually experiencing the illness.
Which is why today's deep dive is so vital.
Exactly. Our mission today is to completely change how you think about going to the doctor, how you think about what it means to be sick, and really about what the word health actually signifies.
We are getting into some profoundly disruptive ideas today.
They are. We are diving into a 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bachara Sahili, and the title is a mouthful. It's called Life Coherent Internal Medicine, a Maturana-informed framework for clinical reasoning, physiology, and capacity restoration.
It sounds incredibly dense.
It does.
And, well, I mean, it's a rigorously academic piece of work, but the core ideas inside this paper represent a revolutionary shift in how we understand the human body and the practice of medicine itself.
It's attempting to solve a crisis of perspective, essentially.
Precisely.
Because the central paradox Dr. Sahili points out, like, right at the very beginning, is something anyone who has navigated the medical system for a chronic issue has probably felt deep in their bones.
Oh, absolutely.
We are living in an era of unprecedented technological and pharmacological power, right?
We can transplant hearts. We can sequence genomes in, what, a matter of hours?
Yeah, we can target specific molecular pathways with biologic drugs. We have functional MRIs to see inside the body in real time.
Yet, amidst all this absolute brilliance, the actual living, breathing patient.
The person.
What the paper calls their living coherence, it often seems to just vanish.
They disappear
into a fragmented list of organ systems, you know, disease codes and lab values.
It's so true. But the paper establishes a very careful foundational premise here, which I think we need to highlight so we don't sound completely anti-science.
Right. Dr. Sahili isn't entirely supportive of modern biomedicine.
Completely. The argument is not that we should abandon our lab tests or that reductionist science is false.
Far from it. The problem is that biomedicine has amassed this enormous vocabulary of facts, but it lacks a living grammar to connect those facts back to the whole person.
A living grammar.
Yeah. We have categorized every single part of the human machine, but in doing so, we've kind of forgotten how to read the complete sentence of the patient's life.
I love that phrasing, but I want to push on that idea of fragmentation a bit.
Yeah.
Because on the surface, having a highly specialized medical system seems like the exact opposite of a problem.
It seems thorough.
Right. It seems super thorough. If I have a heart issue, I want a cardiologist who has spent 20 years looking only at hearts.
Of course.
If I have a kidney issue, give me the nephrologist. We have a specialist for literally every millimeter of the human body. So why is that considered fragmented?
Well, let's look at how a physician is actually trained to perceive a patient. The paper details this opening argument by looking at the standard medical education model. Students are taught to memorize massive, intricate, but ultimately disconnected bodies of knowledge. They do their clinical rotations across totally separated territories.
Right, the different hospital wards.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They spend a month on cardiology, learning the heart's plumbing and electrical systems. Then they pack up and spend a month on nephrology, learning about filtration. Then endocrinology, then psychiatry.
So they are essentially learning different languages for different parts of the body.
Yes, exactly. And they learn the specific diseases, the mechanisms, the investigations, and the pharmacological treatments for each isolated system.
They learn how to recognize abnormal numbers on a chart and assign the correct diagnostic label.
Right. And Dr. Sahili acknowledges that these skills are indispensable. You literally cannot practice medicine without them. But mastering these separate territories does not automatically produce a physician who can see the coherent whole. You learn the parts perfectly, but the mechanism for understanding how those parts dynamically interact as a living person, well, that's often just left out of the curriculum.
It's assumed it'll just naturally happen.
Which it rarely does.
The paper uses a couple of incredibly common clinical presentations to illustrate this gap between the parts and the whole. One of them is dyspnea, which is just shortness of breath, and the other is fatigue.
Let's walk through the shortness of breath example.
Okay, yeah. So if I show up at an urgent care or a clinic and I tell the doctor, hey, I can't catch my breath, what is the internal monologue happening in that physician's head?
The physician has been trained to instantly pull up a diagnostic checklist. They are sorting your symptom into one of those specialized silos we just talked about.
So the different territories.
Right. So the shortness of breath could be a lung issue, maybe pneumonia, asthma, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Sure.
Or it could be a cardiovascular issue, like congestive heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
Or a pulmonary embolism.
Okay, so heart or lungs.
But wait, it could also be hematological, like severe anemia, where you literally just don't have enough red blood cells to carry the oxygen.
Oh, what?
It could be metabolic acidosis. It could even be psychiatric, like a severe panic attack.
That is a terrifyingly broad list. I mean, it spans almost every major organ system in the body.
And the physician's job, conventionally, is to run the tests, to eliminate items on that list until they find the broken part.
But Dr. Saley argues that without a deeper biological grammar, these diagnoses remain just a list of mechanical failures, don't they?
Yes. The student or the doctor might find the pneumonia, they prescribe the antibiotic, and they feel like the job is done.
But they miss the deeper question.
They forget to ask why this specific person, in this specific moment, can no longer transform the available conditions of their life, like the oxygen in the room, into usable vitality.
Let me try an analogy here to see if I'm tracking this, because it reminds me of the difference between a mechanic and a biologist.
Oh, I like that. Go ahead.
So if my car starts making this horrific grinding noise, I take it to a mechanic. The mechanic pulls out their diagnostic checklist. They check the alternator. They look at the spark plugs. They measure the transmission fluid.
They find the broken part.
Exactly. They locate the broken part. They swap it out for a brand new one, and the car drives perfectly again. Because the car is a machine. It responds totally reliably to part replacement.
But humans aren't cars.
No. We are much more like a struggling ecosystem.
A complex, highly dynamic ecosystem. Precisely.
Like, if a biologist is called in to look at a dying lake, they don't walk up, find a sick fish, and say, ah, the fish is broken. Let's swap it for a new fish and the lake will be fine.
No, they wouldn't even think that way.
Right. They would look at the temperature of the water. They'd look at the chemical runoff from the farms 5 miles upstream.
The invasive algae blocking the sunlight.
Yes, the oxygen levels, the seasonal changes. They have to look at the entire living system and its relationship to its environment to understand why that specific fish is struggling.
That analogy perfectly captures the limitation of the mechanical mindset, especially when we start dealing with chronic disease and what we call multimorbidity.
Multimorbidity, having lots of things wrong at once.
Yeah. I mean, the single broken part model works wonderfully for an acute injury, right? A broken bone, a burst appendix.
Swap the part, fix the leak.
Exactly. But look at the average older adult navigating the healthcare system today. They don't just have one broken part. They might have diabetes, hypertension, chronic kidney disease, osteoarthritis, insomnia, and perhaps depression all at the same time.
They have multiple overlapping crises. And under our current model, they are viewed through multiple completely separate lenses.
They go to the endocrinologist, who adjusts their insulin targets for the diabetes. Then they see the nephrologist, who is worried about the kidney disease and tells them to restrict their fluid intake.
Or alters their diet.
Right. Then they see the rheumatologist for the joint pain, who prescribes a strong anti-inflammatory. The psychiatrist handles the depression. Each specialist gives them a different target, different lifestyle advice, and a different prescription.
And the patient goes home with a pill organizer the size of a suitcase.
Totally overwhelmed.
Trying to follow 5 different sets of instructions that might actually be contradicting each other.
Which is incredibly common. The patient's actual illness is not 8 separate diseases operating in 8 separate vacuums inside their body.
Right. Their body is one ecosystem.
Their illness is a conserved, intertwined pattern. It's a pattern of metabolic overload, vascular injury, chronic pain that limits their movement, sleep disruption that fuels inflammatory signaling.
And an immense medication burden on top of all that.
Plus the social stress of managing all these appointments. their participation in daily life just narrows and narrows. The disease labels are entirely real. Diabetes is a real, measurable pathology.
We're not denying that.
No. But those labels do not exhaust the reality of the patient. The patient's life itself has become incoherent.
Understanding that the system is fragmented is a great first step, but, you know, a critique without a solution doesn't actually help the patient sitting in the waiting room.
Sure.
We can't simply ask one doctor to retain the specialized knowledge of 8 different fields. That's practically impossible.
Right.
So how do we unite these fragments? This is where Dr. Sahili introduces the theoretical foundation of the paper. And we need to spend some real time here because it completely flips the script on how we view biology.
It does. To rebuild the grammar of medicine, the paper turns to what it calls the Maturonen Foundation.
Okay.
This is rooted in the work of 2 Chilean biologists and philosophers from the 1970s, Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. They developed this radical theory in the biology of cognition known as autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis. Okay, let's break down the Greek here. Auto means self, and poiesis means creation or production, so self-producing.
Essentially, yes. Maturana and Varela were trying to define what actually makes something alive, like at a fundamental level.
What's the difference between a rock and a cell?
Exactly. They concluded that living systems are autonomous, self-producing unities. They can serve their own organization through continuous structural change.
A rock doesn't do this. A machine doesn't do this.
Right. A living cell or a living human is constantly rebuilding itself, repairing its boundaries, and maintaining its internal environment against the chaos of the outside world.
It's an active process.
Very active. The core idea is that a living system isn't defined just by the physical matter it contains at any given moment, because our cells are constantly dying and being replaced, but by the organization through which it continuously produces itself.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I have to play devil's advocate here. This sounds highly philosophical, and modern medicine is deeply pragmatic.
It is.
Are we really saying a patient isn't a machine? Because we treat the body like a machine constantly, and it often works really well.
It certainly appears to work that way.
Right. We perform bypass surgeries like plumbers clearing out a blocked pipe. We use pharmaceuticals that act like highly specific chemical switches to turn off acid production in the stomach or block a pain receptor. The mechanistic approach saves millions of lives.
And Dr. Sahili would never, ever deny that those mechanistic interventions save lives.
What's the issue?
The danger is confusing the mechanism of the intervention with the nature of the system you are intervening upon. We treat the body as if it were a machine, but the body does not respond as a machine.
It responds as an autopoietic unity.
Yes. This distinction is perhaps the most profound clinical insight in the whole paper. When a physician prescribes a drug, recommends a diet, or performs a surgery, they are not commanding an inert object.
A drug does not walk into the body and dictate terms.
No, it doesn't. It acts as a perturbation. It introduces a disturbance to the living system.
Okay, so the drug enters the system, perturbs it, kind of knocks it off balance, and then the body has to figure out what to do with that new chemical reality.
Exactly. The response to that perturbation is not determined by the drug alone. The response is determined by the body's own internal organization, its unique structural history, its current vulnerabilities, and its available energy reserves.
Wow.
This is the biological reason why the exact same medication, given at the exact same dose for the exact same diagnosis, will have radically different outcomes in different people.
Because their internal organization is different.
Yes. It heals patient A. It causes a catastrophic allergic reaction in patient B. It does absolutely nothing for patient C, and it creates a physiological dependency in patient D.
That makes total sense.
If the body were a machine, the input would reliably equal the output every time. But because you are perturbing a living unity, the organism determines its own response based on its current state.
That makes the concept of clinical trials suddenly look very, very different.
Doesn't.
Yeah. When a trial shows that a drug has a 60% response rate, we often think, oh, the drug is just 60% effective. But really, we are dropping the exact same pebble into thousands of completely different ponds.
Well, that's good.
The ripples behave differently because the shape, the depth, and the temperature of every single pond is unique.
That is a wonderful way to visualize it. And understanding that the pond has a shape brings us to another central concept from Maturana that the paper leans heavily on, which is structural coupling.
Structural coupling. That sounds like a term from civil engineering, like bolting 2 steel beams together. What does that mean in the context of a human body?
It describes the ongoing dynamic relationship between a living system and its environment.
Okay.
a living organism is in a constant state of structural change,
yeah.
right? And those changes are triggered by recurrent interactions with its medium, its world.
So the environment is constantly perturbing the organism.
Exactly. And the organism and the environment essentially co-determine a history of change together. They become coupled.
In medical terms, what does this mean?
It shatters the idea that an illness is just a biological glitch located purely inside the body, or just an external pathogen attacking from the outside. Disease usually emerges as a conserved pattern of the relationship between the organism and its environment.
So we basically can't separate the sick person from the reality of the world they wake up in every single day.
No, you can't. The paper provides a brilliant illustration of this using an asthmatic patient.
Let's hear it.
Conventionally, we think of asthma as a problem of the airways, right? Hyperreactive bronchioles, inflammation, mucus production.
That's the biological mechanism.
That's the mechanism.
Yeah.
But the asthmatic patient doesn't live in a vacuum. They live in a state of structural coupling with their airways, yes, but also with the seasonal allergens in their city.
Right.
With the respiratory viruses going around their workplace,
mm-hmm.
with the presence of black mold or poor ventilation in their apartment.
The actual physical environment.
And the emotional environment. The stress of trying to pay rent. Their financial access to inhalers at the pharmacy.
So the mold on the wall, the stress of the impending eviction, and the fact that their pharmacy is out of stock of their medication. All of these external factors are literally biologically coupled to the inflammation in their lungs.
They are. The social and environmental world literally becomes biological through these recurrent perturbations.
That is heavy.
And it flows in the other direction, too. The biological becomes social through altered action.
How so?
Well, because the patient can't breathe, they can't go to work. Because they can't work, they lose income. That lost income increases their stress, which further triggers their immune system, leading to more lung inflammation.
It's a vicious cycle.
A completely structurally coupled cycle.
Yeah.
You cannot isolate the biology from the social reality. The patient's world isn't just an interesting backstory or an optional context you consider after the quote-unquote real medical work is done.
The world is part of the illness.
The world is part of the conserved pattern in which the illness exists and in which healing must ultimately occur.
Wow. If we accept this premise, that health isn't just about identifying a broken part in a vacuum, but about the organism's ongoing dynamic relationship to its environment, then we are essentially forced to redefine the word health entirely. Our current metrics seem woefully inadequate.
They are. And Dr. Saley offers a powerful new metric in the paper, which he calls the life coherence criterion.
Life coherence. It feels much broader than just asking, are you sick or not?
It is entirely different from our standard definitions. The paper makes it clear that health is not defined as perfect wellness. It is not defined as having a completely clean bill of health or simply possessing normal lab values across the board.
So what is it?
Health is defined as the capacity of a living person to sustain, adapt, repair, regulate, relate, and participate meaningfully in life.
Capacity. It's about what you can do, how you can be in the world, rather than just the absence of a pathology.
Exactly. To deepen this, the paper contrasts two vital terms in medical sociology and physiology, salutogenesis and salugenesis.
Okay, salutogenesis.
Salutogenesis was a concept developed by Aaron Antonovsky, and it focuses on the origins of health, specifically, how certain people manage to remain well and cope despite being under severe stress. It's about resilience.
Okay, resilience makes sense. And salugenesis.
Dr. Saley pushes this further with salugenesis. This refers to the active biological generation and completion of repair.
Generating repair.
Yes. It's the organism's movement away from just defending against an illness toward actively restoring physiological regulation, repairing tissue integrity, and renewing their participation in the world.
So for everyone listening to this right now, I want you to run your own life through this specific lens for a minute. When you evaluate your own health, we usually think about our cholesterol numbers or what the scale said this morning or if our lower back hurts.
Right, the numbers and the symptoms.
But try asking yourself about your capacities instead. What capacities do you currently hold? What is your capacity to adapt when a major stressor hits your life?
What is your capacity to repair your body after a grueling week of work?
Exactly. How well can you regulate your nervous system when you're overwhelmed? Can you participate meaningfully in your relationships, your hobbies, your community?
And on the flip side, what capacities feel like they are narrowing, slipping away, or have been completely lost?
That is such a different way to measure yourself.
And that is the fundamental inquiry of a life-coherent physician. This definition completely alters who we view as healthy or sick.
Give me an example of how that flips.
Well, under this framework, a person living with a severe, incurable chronic illness, perhaps someone using a wheelchair due to a permanent spinal cord injury, can possess a profound degree of health.
Really? Even with a permanent injury?
Yes. If they retain their agency, their capacity to adapt to their environment, their ability to regulate their emotions, and their participation in a meaningful life, they are life coherent. They have health.
I see.
Now contrast that with an executive who walks into a clinic, runs a mile on a treadmill perfectly, and has immaculate blood work.
The picture of conventional health.
Right. But that executive's capacity to sleep is completely destroyed. Their ability to regulate their stress is gone, their relationships are crumbling, and their participation in anything outside of work has collapsed. Conventionally, the executive is perfectly healthy and the wheelchair user is disabled. But life coherently, the executive is profoundly unwell, and their system is on the verge of catastrophic failure.
That is a massive paradigm shift. But to make this philosophy actually actionable, the paper outlines what it calls the seven primitives of life-coherent internal medicine. Dr. Sahuli frames these as the foundational grammar of this new language.
Yes, the primitives.
I want to try to weave these into how a doctor actually looks at a patient rather than just listing them off like a textbook.
That's definitely the best way to understand them, as a sequence of observations. The very first primitive is simply recognizing the patient as a living unity. The physician has to consciously remind themselves that the person sitting on the exam table is an organism, person, world unity, not a collection of subassemblies. You have to ask, what is the whole living pattern I'm witnessing here?
And once you see the whole, you have to actually figure out what's wrong, which requires making a clinical distinction. That's the second primitive.
Yes, and this draws heavily on Maturana's philosophy of the observer. A diagnosis isn't an absolute truth floating out there in the universe.
It's not.
No, it depends entirely on what the clinician has the tools, the training, and the perspective to see, name, and test. A life-coherent doctor asks, what specific pattern am I distinguishing right now? And more importantly, what am I failing to distinguish? What is my own specialized lens causing me to miss?
I like that humility. Then we bring in what we discussed earlier, structural coupling, which is the third primitive, looking at the environment maintaining the illness.
Right.
But the fourth primitive is where the rubber really meets the road, I think. Life capacity.
Absolutely.
The doctor isn't just asking what is broken, but what capacity for viable living has been lost.
And that leads directly into the fifth primitive, energy transformation. Because a capacity is completely useless if you don't have the energy to fuel it.
You can't repair a house without electricity and workers.
Exactly. This looks at how the patient's metabolism, their sleep, cellular health, and stress levels determine if they can actually transform the resources available to them into usable vitality.
Then you look at boundary and exchange, right? That's the sixth, because life requires highly regulated borders.
Absolutely. The gut lining, the blood-brain barrier, the cellular membranes, and even psychological and social boundaries. If a boundary fails or an exchange process breaks down, chaos enters the system.
And the final primitive is the repair trajectory.
Yes. How do we know the treatment actually worked? Not because the symptom is temporarily suppressed, but because the patient is moving toward durable repair and renewed participation in their life.
Look, the philosophical primitives are fascinating. I love tearing apart the theoretical framework.
It is fun.
But I keep imagining a primary hair doctor on a random Tuesday morning.
Oh, the reality of the clinic.
Yes. The waiting room is full. They have exactly 15 minutes per patient. The electronic health record is demanding a diagnostic code so they can bill insurance. And the patient is sitting there waiting for a quick answer.
Right.
That doctor does not have the time to sit down, stroke their chin, and debate the epistemological boundaries of structural coupling. How does this actually work in practice?
The paper anticipates this exact critique. Theory without application is useless at the bedside. So Dr. Saheli introduces a highly structured, highly practical six-step method called the Life Coherent Clinical Loop.
A loop.
Yes. This is designed to be executed efficiently in real-time clinical practice. It guides the physician's reasoning process from the very moment they walk into the room.
Okay, walk us through how this loop plays out in a clinical encounter. Someone walks into the ER or the clinic. What is the absolute first thing the doctor must do?
The first step is to recognize and stabilize danger. Yes. The paper is uncompromising on this point. Life-coherent medicine does not replace emergency medicine or acute stabilization.
So if I'm bleeding out.
If a patient comes in with crushing chest pain or massive bleeding or their blood pressure is crashing from sepsis, you do not sit down and ask about their emotional relationship to their environment.
Right. You save their life.
You ask, what can kill or permanently damage this unity right now? You use every biomedical tool available, defibrillators, broad-spectrum antibiotics, emergency surgery, to stabilize the danger.
Okay, so you stop the bleeding. The patient is stable. What happens next?
The second step is to distinguish the syndrome. This is classic, rigorous medical diagnosis. You take the history, you perform the physical exam, you run the labs, you order the imaging.
The standard stuff.
You recognize the clinical pattern. Is this an exacerbation of heart failure? Is it community-acquired pneumonia? Is it acute kidney injury? You give the biological pattern a name.
So the first two steps are essentially standard, high-quality, modern medicine. Keep them alive and figure out what the immediate pathology is.
Yes. But step three is where the paradigm shifts. Step three is locate the capacity failure.
Ah, moving from pathology to capacity.
Exactly. You don't stop at the label of pneumonia. You ask the deeper functional question. What specific life capacity has been lost here?
So instead of just infected lungs, what are you asking?
Is this primarily a failure of oxygenation? Is it a failure of immune defense to clear a pathogen? Is it a collapse of energy transformation because the infection has completely depleted their reserves?
By naming the lost capacity, you automatically start thinking about how to restore it rather than just how to kill the bacteria.
Precisely.
Which leads to step four, mapping the environment.
Step four, map the coupling conditions. What are the circumstances maintaining this illness or preventing recovery?
Like the mold in the apartment.
Or is the patient sleeping? Are they exposed to environmental toxins at work? Do they have food insecurity that prevents them from getting the nutrition needed for tissue repair?
Or emotional stress.
Are they carrying a massive, unrelenting caregiving burden at home that is keeping their nervous system in a constant, highly inflammatory state of threat? You map the forces acting upon the organism.
Once you see the danger, the syndrome, the lost capacity, and the environmental factors, you have to actually do something about it. Step five is the intervention.
Dr. Silley calls this wise perturbation.
I love that phrasing, wise perturbation.
It's beautiful. The goal is to introduce an intervention that restores the patient's viability with the absolute minimum harm. It's a calculated nudge.
Not a sledgehammer.
Right. It might be prescribing a highly targeted medication. It might be surgery. But it might also be a social intervention, like connecting them with housing support.
Or taking something away.
And very often, the wisest perturbation is taking medication away, deprescribing something that is causing more side effects than benefits.
And the final step is seeing if it actually worked.
Step six, observe the repair trajectory. Did the perturbation actually restore their life capacity? Did their walking distance improve? Are they sleeping soundly?
Did they regain their sense of agency?
Exactly. Or did we just successfully fix a number on a spreadsheet while the patient continues to suffer?
Look, I can hear the objections from the medical community already. Even with a structured loop, taking the time to map coupling conditions and assess capacity failure seems like it requires way more time than just writing a prescription for a symptom and moving to the next room.
It does sound like it takes longer.
And in our current healthcare system, time is the rarest and most expensive commodity.
That is the most common pushback. But the paper counters this by analyzing where time is actually wasted in modern medicine.
Where is it wasted?
What truly drains the system's time and what causes immense suffering for patients is the cycle of endless compensatory management.
Compensatory management, the prescribing cascade. Break down how that cycle traps a patient because this happens all the time.
It's a devastatingly common scenario. A patient comes in with mildly elevated blood pressure. The doctor, pressed for time, focuses on fixing the number. They prescribe a calcium channel blocker like amlodipine.
Okay, standard protocol.
It works. The blood pressure number looks great on the chart, but the perturbation causes a side effect. The patient develops edema, significant swelling in their ankles.
Oh no!
Because their ankles are swollen, they stop taking their evening walks, they lose their cardiovascular conditioning, and they start gaining weight.
So the intervention fixed the number but damaged their capacity to move.
Exactly. Then, a few months later, they return to the clinic complaining of the swelling. The doctor, managing the new symptom, prescribes a diuretic like furosemide to clear the fluid.
Another pill.
The fluid clears, but the diuretic causes them to lose potassium and makes them have to use the bathroom constantly throughout the night.
So now their sleep is ruined.
Now their sleep architecture is completely destroyed. The chronic sleep deprivation drives up their cortisol, increases their insulin resistance, and a year later, their blood work shows they are pre-diabetic.
You're kidding.
So they come back, taking more clinic time, and get a prescription for metformin.
A third pill.
And the metformin causes severe gastrointestinal distress. We spend years and millions of dollars managing the side effects of our own narrow interventions because we never stop to address the initial capacity failure or the coupling conditions in the first place.
So investing the time to run the life coherent loop up front is actually a massive efficiency measure. It breaks the cycle of chasing symptoms.
Precisely.
The paper includes this fascinating table to help students visualize the shift called capacity systems physiology. It compares how we traditionally categorize organs versus how we should view them life coherently.
It's a brilliant educational tool. Traditionally, a medical student learns anatomy. They study the lungs, then the blood, then the cellular acid-base balance.
All separate chapters in the textbook.
Right. But the life coherent interpretation groups all of these under a single functional umbrella, oxygenation. Oxygenation is the capacity to bring oxygen from the atmosphere into a usable, productive relationship with the tissues.
It forces the student to see the function, not just the physical structure.
Exactly.
Another great example is how we view the kidneys and the liver.
Conventionally, they are taught as entirely separate organs in different body cavities. But functionally, life coherently, they're both part of the capacity for clearance and transformation.
Their job is to clean the system.
Their job is to filter the blood, excrete waste, detoxify harmful compounds, and regulate the body's internal burden. They work together for a single capacity.
I want to zoom in on one specific capacity mentioned in that loop because I think it unlocks so much of the mystery surrounding modern chronic illness. That capacity is energy transformation.
Oh, this is a big one.
And we cannot talk about biological energy without talking about the most famous organelle in the human body.
The mitochondria.
Every single person who survived middle school biology remembers the exact same phrase. Mm-hmm. It is universally burned into our collective consciousness. The mitochondria is...
the powerhouse of the cell.
The powerhouse of the cell. We all picture these little jelly bean-shaped power plants just mindlessly shoveling coal into the furnace to make ATP, the energy currency of the body.
It's a cute image.
But Dr. Saul Healy's paper suggests that this middle school metaphor is not just incomplete, it is actually actively hindering our understanding of chronic disease.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Why is it wrong to just think of them as tiny power plants?
Because contemporary mitochondrial biology has moved so far beyond that simple model. What's fascinating here is that the field is advancing at breakneck speed, and what we are finding is that mitochondria are incredibly complex, dynamic organelles.
They don't just burn fuel.
No. Yes, they manufacture ATP from fuel and oxygen, but they're not just blind generators. They are highly sensitive environmental sensors.
Sensors.
They are redox regulators managing the delicate balance of oxidative stress in the cell. They are massive immune metabolic signaling platforms.
Wait, I want to pause on that. They're involved in the immune system. I always thought the immune system was just white blood cells and antibodies fighting off bacteria.
The immune system relies heavily on mitochondrial signaling to even know what to do. Mitochondria help regulate the entire inflammatory response.
Oh, wow. They manage cellular calcium levels, which dictate how a cell functions. They even control apoptosis, which is the programmed death of a damaged cell, to protect the larger organism.
Right.
They are essentially the ultimate mediators of biological capacity.
So they sit right at the center of everything.
They sit at the strategic intersection of absolutely everything we experience.
So they are taking inputs from everywhere.
Everywhere. The oxygen you breathe, the glucose and fats you eat, the quality and duration of your sleep, your daily physical movement, your exposure to environmental toxins or medications.
All of it goes to the mitochondria.
And crucially, your autonomic tone.
Autonomic tone, meaning the background stress level of your nervous system, whether you fundamentally feel safe or threatened.
Yes, even social stress. The anxiety of a toxic workplace, the fear of infection, the trauma of discrimination is chemically translated by the nervous system and the endocrine system. And that signal arrives directly at the mitochondria.
That is incredible.
All of these disparate elements of human life converge on mitochondrial function. They take the conditions of our life and translate them into a fundamental decision.
Which is?
Do we have the capacity to adapt and repair, or do we need to shut down, defend, and preserve resources.
They're the biological translators. They read the environment and decide if we have usable energy.
Yes.
This leads to a distinction in the paper that I found incredibly profound, drawing on research by Liu and colleagues regarding a concept called mitoception.
Mitoception, yes. How mitochondria perceive the world.
The paper draws a hard line between an energy deficit and an energy gap.
This distinction is vital. It's the key to understanding illnesses like chronic fatigue syndrome, long COVID, and severe burnout.
Let's start with an energy deficit. What is that?
A deficit is a straightforward supply problem. The required inputs to make energy are physically missing.
Give me a clinical example of a deficit.
Severe anemia is a classic deficit. You literally do not have enough hemoglobin in your red blood cells to carry sufficient oxygen to your tissues. Starvation is a deficit. You lack the caloric fuel. Hypoxemia, perhaps from severe lung disease or being in extreme high altitude, is a deficit. You lack atmospheric oxygen.
So in all these cases, the organism lacks the physical fuel or the chemical elements necessary to manufacture energy.
Exactly.
That makes perfect sense. To use the car analogy again, the gas tank is completely empty. The engine is totally fine, but there's nothing to burn.
Right.
What then is an energy gap?
An energy gap is a vastly more complex systemic issue. In a gap, the demand for energy exceeds the body's capacity to transform the available resources into usable vitality.
But the fuel is there.
The fuel is present. The oxygen is present. The supply is there, but the body refuses or is unable to process it.
So the gas tank is totally full, the fuel lines are primed, but the engine is flooded, or the computer system is artificially capping the RPMs to prevent the engine from overheating.
Exactly. And clinically, this presents a massive challenge. A patient with an energy gap can sit in an exam room and all their basic metrics look absolutely fantastic.
Perfect on paper.
Their oxygen saturation is a perfect 99%. Their blood glucose is normal. They're eating a well-rounded diet with plenty of calories. Their basic metabolic blood panel comes back completely unremarkable.
From a deficit perspective, they have everything they need.
But the patient is experiencing crushing, disabling fatigue, severe cognitive fog, or profound post-exertional malaise where taking a simple shower leaves them bedbound for 2 days.
Because their mitochondria are looking at the environment, sensing danger, and literally refusing to transform the fuel.
Yes. The mitochondria have shifted away from energy production and into a defensive cell danger response.
Why would they do that if the fuel is there?
The transformation process is actively impaired by chronic inflammatory signaling, by severe sleep disruption, by past trauma that has altered their cortisol rhythms, by endocrine disturbances, or by overwhelming social and psychological overload.
Wow.
The mitochondria are effectively saying, it is not safe to spend energy on repairing tissue or running the brain right now. We need to hunker down and survive this threat.
Understanding this difference between a deficit and a gap feels so incredibly important for the emotional well-being of patients. The paper actually uses a very heavy term here. It says that failing to understand this distinction causes patients moral injury.
It does.
That's not a phrase you usually see in a physiology paper. Moral injury.
It's a strong phrase, but it captures the tragedy of the current system perfectly. Think about what the typical patient with an energy gap experiences.
They feel awful. They can't function.
Right. They go to the doctor hoping for an answer. The doctor, trained primarily to look for deficits, runs the standard labs. Complete blood count, metabolic panel, thyroid function, maybe an EKG.
And all the results come back in the normal range.
The doctor looks at the data and assumes that normal inputs equal normal capacity.
And so when the patient says, I still can't get out of bed, the doctor has no biological explanation left.
And nature abhors a vacuum, especially in medicine.
Yeah.
When the biological tests are normal, but the patient is still complaining, the system often defaults to psychological blame.
Oh, right. It's all in your head.
The doctor might gently suggest it's just stress. Or they might assume the patient is overly anxious, deeply depressed, lacking motivation, or even actively exaggerating their symptoms for secondary gain.
That is heartbreaking. And anyone who has been chronically ill knows exactly what you're describing. Patients are essentially gaslit by the medical establishment.
Yes.
They are told their physical suffering is a character flaw or a psychiatric failure simply because the system's tools are only calibrated to measure empty gas tanks, not flooded engines.
The life-coherent approach prevents this moral injury. It gives the physician the scientific framework to say, I see that your fuel levels are normal, but I understand that your transformation capacity is impaired. I believe you.
And now let's figure out what is forcing your mitochondria into this defensive state.
Exactly. It validates the patient's lived reality through a deeper, more accurate understanding of physiology.
With all of this new expansive understanding of energy, capacity, structural coupling, and biology, how does a doctor actually put this into practice for the most difficult chronic conditions?
Right, the application.
Because Dr. Seki-Lees isn't just dealing in theory here. The paper mentions he is actively preparing a clinical textbook called Internal Medicine Made Easy.
The white paper we are discussing serves as the rigorous academic foundation for that future student-facing textbook. And to prove that this philosophy can handle the daily grind of medicine, the paper walks through several specific clinical translations.
Let's explore a couple of those case studies. I want to look at case one, a patient presenting with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, or CKD.
Very common.
This is bread and butter internal medicine. How does conventional care manage this patient versus a life coherent approach?
Conventional care focuses heavily and appropriately on managing biomarkers and targets. The doctor will monitor the HbA1c to track long-term blood sugar.
Right.
They will obsess over the blood pressure, keeping it below a specific threshold to protect the kidneys. They will track the EGFR, which measures how well the kidneys are filtering waste.
All the numbers.
They will calculate cardiovascular risk, prescribe the optimal cocktail of ACE inhibitors, statins, and hypoglycemic agents, and give strict instructions on a low-sodium, low-sugar diet.
Right. The goal is to keep all the numbers in the green zone to slow down the damage to the machine.
It is entirely necessary, but it is incomplete. The life coherent approach steps back and runs the clinical loop. The doctor asks, what actual capacities are narrowing in this human being?
So looking beyond the blood sugar.
It's not just about blood sugar. It's about a loss of systemic metabolic flexibility.
Oh.
The body's ability to switch smoothly between burning carbs and burning fats.
Okay.
It's a narrowing of vascular resilience, meaning their blood vessels can't dilate and contract properly. It's a loss of wound repair capacity, meaning a small cut on their foot could turn into an amputation.
Wow, yeah.
It's a compromise of their immune defense and their peripheral nerve function.
But it doesn't stop at the skin, right? The structural coupling aspect forces the doctor to look wider.
Exactly. It zooms out to the organism-medium relationship. The doctor must assess the patient's food autonomy.
Food autonomy? Mean what?
Are we telling a patient to eat a pristine, fresh vegetable diet when they live in a food desert, rely on public transit, and can only afford highly processed, calorie-dense foods from a corner store?
You can't prescribe a diet they physically cannot access.
What about their future participation in life? Are they losing mobility due to neuropathy? How is the financial toxicity of all these medications impacting their daily stress levels?
The cost of the drugs is a perturbation.
Yes. A life-coherent approach integrates the complex biochemistry of the kidneys and mitochondria with the harsh realities of the patient's behavioral, social, and economic world. It makes the care plan realistic.
Let's move to case two, because this section of the paper completely reframed how I view aging. The topic is frailty.
Ah, frailty.
We all have a colloquial understanding of what frailty is. You picture an elderly person. They shrink a little bit. They walk much slower. Their grip is weak. They seem fragile. We just accept it as the inevitable wear and tear of getting old.
Frailty is one of the most profound examples of life capacity narrowing. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the paper cites the seminal work of Linda Freid and colleagues to redefine frailty not just as getting old, but as a highly specific systemic state.
The systemic state.
Frailty is a state of reduced adaptive reserve across multiple physiological systems simultaneously. It's not just the muscles getting weak.
What else is happening?
It's the mitochondria producing less energy, the circulatory system becoming stiffer, the immune system losing its ability to mount a fast response, and the cognitive networks losing their elasticity.
So it's not a single broken part. It's the entire biological safety net wearing thin. I want to try an analogy here.
Let's hear it.
I liken this systemic loss of reserve to a household budget.
Okay.
If you are financially secure, you have a massive savings account. That savings account is your adaptive reserve. If your water heater explodes or your car needs a new transmission, you write a check.
It hurts, but you survive.
It's incredibly annoying, but you survive the perturbation easily. Your system remains stable. But if you are living paycheck to paycheck, if your household is financially frail, any unexpected expense threatens to bankrupt the entire system.
Right.
A $200 flat tire means you can't pay rent, which means you get evicted, which means you lose your job. A tiny perturbation triggers a catastrophic collapse.
That is a phenomenal analogy for frailty. In a frail patient, the margin between their ordinary daily baseline and their absolute maximum sustainable capacity has become incredibly narrow.
Their biological savings account is almost empty.
You can look at a frail patient sitting quietly in a chair, and they might look completely stable. Their vitals are fine. But because they have no reserve, a very minor perturbation will crash their system.
Like the flat tire.
If they get a minor urinary tract infection, something a younger person might just find annoying, the inflammatory response overwhelms their fragile neurochemistry, and they rapidly spiral into profound delirium.
Oh my God.
Or if a doctor changes one of their blood pressure medications slightly, they get dizzy, fall, fracture a hip, and never walk again.
If frailty means the savings account is empty, what is the wise perturbation in this scenario? You can't prescribe a drug to cure old age. You can't magically deposit biological reserves back into their account. How does a doctor treat frailty life coherently?
The guiding principle becomes proportionality and protection. You must meticulously match your interventions to the patient's remaining fragile reserve. Very often, the wisest perturbation in geriatrics is about aggressively reducing the biological burden.
Deprescribing.
Yes. Reviewing their medication list and stopping any drug that is no longer strictly necessary, because every single drug requires hepatic and renal capacity to process.
It takes energy to process a pill.
It means addressing their chronic pain so they can maintain their mobility, but doing so with immense care to avoid sedating medications that increase their risk of falling.
Walking a tightrope.
It means prioritizing the fundamentals: nutrient-dense food and uninterrupted sleep. And crucially, it means moving heaven and earth to avoid hospitalizing them if it's at all safe to treat them at home.
Because the hospital itself is a perturbation.
The hospital is a massive, depleting perturbation. It's an environment of constant alarms, bright lights, interrupted sleep, unfamiliar routines, and exposure to virulent pathogens.
It drains whatever reserve they have left.
For a frail patient, the hospital environment alone can drain their last bit of adaptive reserve. Life coherent care for the frail focuses on functional goals that the patient actually cares about.
Like what?
The repair trajectory is not measured by getting their blood sugar perfectly normal. It's measured by fewer falls, preserving their cognitive clarity so they can talk to their family, and maintaining their dignity and participation in their own home.
Everything we've discussed today, from the asthmatic patient's apartment to the frail patient's risk of hospitalization to the diabetic's food autonomy, points to a massive, unavoidable realization.
It does.
If chronic illness is driven by the environment, and if treating that illness requires mapping the patient's structural coupling to their world, then medicine simply cannot exist in a vacuum, completely walled off from the society it serves.
Which brings us to the most expansive and perhaps the most challenging concept in Dr. Sekaly's paper, the civil commons.
The civil commons. I've heard the term the commons in economics, but what does it mean in a medical context?
The civil commons refers to the shared, collective life support systems that human beings rely upon to flourish and maintain their autopoiesis.
So infrastructure.
We are talking about the foundational infrastructure of human survival. Clean, potable water, breathable air, mm-hmm. safe, secure housing, an agricultural system that produces nourishing, accessible food.
Public health infrastructure.
Robust public health infrastructure, accessible education, safe working conditions, and even abstract but vital elements like social trust, community cohesion, and the availability of meaningful work.
The societal foundation of health. When those foundations are strong, the individual's adaptive reserve is supported. What happens when those foundations begin to crumble?
When the civil commons is neglected, degraded, or destroyed, human bodies absorb the consequences. Dr. Sekaly uses a hauntingly precise phrase to describe this dynamic.
What's the phrase?
He states that chronic disease ultimately becomes the biological ledger of social incoherence.
The biological ledger of social incoherence, that is a heavy concept to digest. Our bodies are essentially keeping the receipts for every systemic failure in our society.
They are keeping the ledger.
The industrial pollution, the grinding stress of poverty, the chronic anxiety of inequality, the isolation of modern life. It doesn't just stay in the political or economic sphere. It gets written down in our biology.
Yes.
It alters our mitochondrial signaling. It shortens our telomeres. It keeps our cortisol elevated. And it drives chronic inflammation.
The social determinants of health are not just external sociological variables that sit outside the medical chart. They are the literal medium through which human bodies become sick or well.
I understand the philosophy, and I agree with the premise, but I have to ask a deeply practical question here. If sickness is fundamentally caused by bad housing or poverty or systemic inequality, what on earth is a doctor supposed to do about it? An internal medicine physician is trained to prescribe statins, interpret EKGs, and manage complex pharmacology. They cannot write a prescription for a new house. They cannot prescribe a living wage or a union or social trust. If we make the doctor responsible for the civil commons, aren't we making their job impossible?
It is a profound and valid challenge. But the paper argues that acknowledging this reality doesn't make the physician's job impossible. It clarifies their true role. Dr. Saley outlines three distinct vital roles that the life-coherent internist is asked to embrace.
Let's walk through those three roles.
First and foremost, they remain a clinician.
Okay, stabilizing the danger.
They must skillfully stabilize danger and treat acute disease using every advanced tool of modern biomedicine. If a patient is having a severe asthma attack triggered by black mold in their slumlord-owned apartment, you do not sit by their bed and lecture them about housing policy while they suffocate.
Right. You administer bronchodilators, oxygen, and systemic steroids to save their life.
The biological crisis still requires a biomedical intervention.
Okay, what is the second role?
Second, they are a healer. Once the danger is stabilized, they engage the life-coherent clinical loop. They work to restore life capacity and support salutogenesis.
Helping them adapt?
They help the patient navigate their complex environment, advising them on how to minimize harm and maximize viable living within their constraints, utilizing whatever social supports and targeted medical therapies are actually available.
And the third role? This is the one that steps outside the clinic.
The third role is the witness.
A witness.
Yes, because physicians sit at the exact convergence point where societal failure becomes biological reality. They possess a unique and heavy responsibility.
To see what's happening.
They must identify and speak truthfully about recurring patterns of life harm that exceed the capacity of the individual patient to fix.
Give me an example.
If a pediatrician sees 10 different children from the exact same housing complex presenting with severe lead poisoning or asthma, they are no longer just treating isolated cases of disease. They are witnessing a catastrophic failure of the civil commons.
And it's crucial to emphasize that the paper doesn't frame this as political activism, does it? It frames it as scientific accuracy.
Precisely. To point out that unsafe housing is causing asthma, or that agricultural food deserts are driving the diabetes epidemic, or that extreme work stress is causing heart attacks, is not the politicization of medicine. As Dr. Saley powerfully writes, it is simply fidelity to the living conditions of health. It is telling the biological truth.
Changing the paradigm of medicine, this drastically requires a total overhaul of how we train the next generation of doctors. It goes back to the educational agenda mentioned at the beginning of the paper. How do you assess a medical student on their ability to be a clinician, a healer, and a witness?
It's a huge challenge for medical schools.
It's easy to test if they memorize the Krebs cycle on a multiple choice exam, but how do you objectively test if they understand structural coupling?
The paper actually provides a fascinating rubric for medical educators. It argues we must move beyond assessing students solely on rote recall or mechanistic pathways.
So what do they look for instead?
When a medical student presents a case on morning rounds, the attending physician shouldn't just ask for the differential diagnosis. They need to assess the student's ability to recognize generative distinctions.
Generative distinctions.
Are they identifying the actual life capacity that has failed? Can they articulate the organism medium conditions that are conserving the illness? And most importantly, does the treatment plan they propose represent a genuine wise perturbation that respects the patient's agency and promotes durable repair?
It's moving the bar. It changes the ultimate question of medical education from, did you get the right answer on the exam, to, did you see the whole living pattern of the human being in front of you? And did you introduce a perturbation that helped restore their capacity to live?
Exactly. It's a fundamental shift from competency-based education, which often just measures a student's ability to perform observable mechanical tasks, to instilling a deep generative reasoning grammar beneath those competencies.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today, and I feel like my brain has been completely rewired.
It's a lot to take in.
We started by looking at modern medicine as this incredibly advanced, highly specialized, but ultimately fragmented machine repair shop. And over the last hour, Dr. Saley's Maturana-informed framework has systematically dismantled that illusion.
It is a necessary dismantling. We've traced the journey from seeing the patient as a broken machine that needs a defective part swapped out to recognizing the patient as an autopoietic living unity.
A unity that is deeply structurally coupled to its environment.
And that needs its capacity for viable living actively restored.
We've learned that a medical treatment is never a simple command. It's a perturbation that the body responds to based on its own history. We've learned that health is so much more than normal lab values. It's the dynamic capacity to adapt, repair, and participate in a meaningful life.
And we dug deep into the biology.
We really did, to discover that mitochondria aren't just mindless cellular powerhouses. They are the brilliant translators of our lived experience, sensing our stress and our environment to determine if we face a simple energy deficit or a complex systemic energy gap.
Deficit versus gap.
Crucial.
We explored how frailty is the terrifying loss of our biological savings account, and ultimately how chronic disease serves as the indisputable ledger of our society's failures. This profound shift in perspective raises an important question for you, the listener, as you navigate your own life. We asked you earlier to think about your capacities. I hope you now see, with total clarity, that your health is not a static number written on a medical chart.
It's dynamic.
It is a dynamic, highly sensitive, ongoing relationship with your environment, the food you eat, the stress you carry, the air you breathe, the community you rely on, and the mitochondria constantly taking notes on all of it.
We started this deep dive talking about the comfort of the X-ray machine. We all want that jagged white line that shows exactly what's broken in crisp black and white. It's clean, it's binary, it's easy to understand.
It's comforting.
But human life, true, coherent, vibrant life, doesn't show up on an X-ray. It exists in the murky waters, in the messy, beautiful, complex ecosystem of your daily existence. So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you go about your week, whether you are managing a chronic illness, caring for someone who is, or just trying to stay well in a chaotic world.
What's the thought?
If your autopoietic body is indeed a biological ledger, constantly and faithfully recording the social, environmental, and emotional incoherence around you, what exactly is your ledger writing down today? What story is it recording? And more importantly, what intentional, wise perturbation can you introduce into your own medium tomorrow to change that story for the better?